Dad, this is ludicrous. Why do you keep avoiding the doctor?
Because I feel fine. I'll go to the doctor when I don't feel fine. Besides, I don't like Dr. Jennings. He's got a model of a colon on his desk. He keeps his tongue depressors in it.
My doctor thinks I'm taking hallucinogenic drugs. How do I know? Let's just say a little bird told me.
Mrs. Simpson, I'm afraid your husband is dead. April Fool's. He's very much alive.
Doctors are the worst of all. You pick up the same disease three or four times, they start lecturing you like it's your fault. You want a bite?
Not if you skipped it to me across a pool of disinfectant.
The doctor said I wouldn't have so many nosebleeds if I kept my finger out of there.
Liability waiver.
Don't read it, just sign it. It simply says you won't hold us responsible if you die as a result of gross negligence. It's a standard form.
Think you should call him and apologize?
Yes, he's a doctor.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. And it's time for the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA. I'm Rob Snow, and the phone lines are wide open right now at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA, 1-800-580-2372. Encourage you, as I always do, to call early, because we left a couple of folks on the line last week, and I just hate to do that. We'd like to get through all the calls before the hour ends. 521-TALK, star 580, or 1-800-580-CFRA. And I should make a note that you're not here next week.
I am not
you
here next week.
You will be vacationing in sunny Florida, and enjoy that.
Thank you.
So, again, folks, 521-TALK, star 580, 1-800-580-CFRA. Are you doing your Sunday show? Will you be here Sunday?
I will not be here this Sunday.
You won't be here this Sunday.
The next live Sunday house call will be first week in January.
Okay. So,
this is it.
This is it. Last house call for 2011. Let's get right to the phones. Paul in Brockville. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, sir. You're on with Dr. Dworkin.
Okay, good afternoon, doctor.
Afternoon.
What I'm calling about is, I believe I have plantar fasciitis.
Okay.
The heel of my foot underneath, when I get up in the morning, it's terribly painful. As mm-hmm. I walk on during the day, it comes pretty good.
Right.
I occasionally get it during the day if I sit down for a bit and that, and then I get up, I occasionally feel it again. What can you tell me about it, and how can I cure it?
Well, plantar fasciitis usually happens because of too much strain on the foot, usually because the foot is not supported very well, or the type of activity that someone is doing during the day ends up putting a lot of strain on that foot. So, for example, people that tend to walk on concrete floors if they're working in warehouses or construction sites or anywhere where there's a lot of hard surfaces that you're walking on, depending also on the footwear that's being used, can certainly contribute to that. The mechanism of what this is, there is a structure called the plantar fascia. This is a cord of ligaments. They're very almost as strong as steel that run from your heel all the way to the bottoms of your toes on the bottom of your foot. And this cord acts as a support that runs front to back. So, for example, if you're stepping, and we know how the arch of the foot normally goes. So when you are stepping down onto the ground, what this cord does is it prevents your foot from collapsing. It prevents the arch from flattening out because it's holding both ends together. It's like having an arch on a bridge, and the ends of the bridges are your foundation, and that keeps that arch in place. Well, this sort of does the same thing. So sometimes what happens is that when you put too much stress on these cords, they tear. And they usually will tear around the heel, as you've explained. And it's more painful in the morning because the foot tends to tighten up overnight. The cords themselves, those ligaments, get tighter. And when you first step down on them, you're literally stretching the cord that already has tears in it. And that it obviously starts to hurt again. And it gets less so as the foot warms up and stretches and you get less pain. The treatment for plantar fasciitis is usually supportive measures for the foot. That is, having proper shoes that will absorb a lot of shock on the ground, but also orthotics are usually used for this to be able to provide better support for the arch and reduce the strain on the plantar fascia. It can take some time for that condition to improve, but you have to have the proper, as I said, the proper foot support to be able to at least start that process onwards. There's very few exercises that'll make this work any better. There's very little muscle in the foot itself. It's primarily bone, ligaments, cartilage, and tendons from muscles that attach into it. And so doing, massage on the foot and such, not really going to help too much. It certainly can feel good, but it's not necessarily going to make this heal any faster. So the bottom line to this is there are some really excellent places to go that will look at the feet, determine if you need the orthotic because of the foot not being properly supported, if the arch is not the greatest, if the foot is shifted a bit. They'll be able to help you with that, and that should help reduce that pain over time that you're experiencing in the foot.
Would that be a podiatrist?
Don't have to go to a podiatrist. Any of the foot centers that are around town, I don't want to mention any specific names, but any of the foot centers where they will analyze the foot, do proper evaluation of your gait and walking, and also usually take a cast of your foot to determine if you need an orthotic, they will do the assessment. And there's usually no charge for that particular assessment. It's more if you require something for the foot thereafter that usually the charge ensues.
Okay. Off to LaPeche and Margaret. Go ahead, Margaret.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dorkin.
Afternoon.
I'm wondering what you can tell me about the C. difficile virus.
Well, it's
bacteria.
Not, yeah, it's a bacteria, not
yeah.
a virus. Everybody says C. difficile, and because we tend to say that on the radio, it's actually C. difficile
okay.
is the actual pronunciation for it. And it is a what you would almost call an opportunistic bacteria. That is, it tends to cause problems when the normal bacteria that exist in your intestine that provide normal intestinal function, digestion, maintaining the health of your intestine, gets destroyed or their populations are decimated by usually antibiotic use.
Yeah.
And usually long-term antibiotic use.
Yeah.
So this is why you tend to see it in hospitals more so than in the community because people tend to be more sick. They tend to have other chronic medical conditions, and they're using intravenous antibiotics to treat their infections. And as a consequence of use of those antibiotics, you can then destroy the bacteria in the intestine, and the C. difficile takes over because now nothing is stopping it from growing. It's not held in check anymore, and it starts to grow. The problem with that is it can cause bad diarrhea, intestinal infection, and complicates treatment protocols for people that are really sick. And that's why people can succumb to their illnesses, because this infection can be sometimes very difficult to control. And getting dehydrated and having diarrhea all the time does not help the process in terms of absorbing any food that you're trying to eat or even recovering from other diseases. And it's quite contagious, because if one person has it and you are providing assistance or care to them, the spores from the bacteria can land up on your hands, can be applied onto countertops, and other people can pick them up and then spread the disease to someone else who's more susceptible. That's sort of what, in a nutshell, what this disease is doing.
Let's go to Troy in Ottawa. Question about gallstones. Troy.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I had my gallbladder removed in 2008.
Okay.
And since then, and more recently, I've been having the same symptoms of attacks of passing gallstones.
Okay.
It's very painful. Usually strikes me in the middle of the night. It's exactly the same pain as before. But what's worse now is that I end up spending most of the next day like vomiting stomach acid and feeling quite sick.
So this happens at night when you're sleeping?
Yeah. It's usually like the last three or four times it's happened, it's woken me up in the middle of the night.
Okay.
And then, so I'm supposed to go for an ultrasound, but I'm, because the first time it happened was a couple of years ago, I was brought to the hospital because of it, because mm-hmm. there was so much pain, and they did an ultrasound there, but they couldn't see anything.
Right.
So I'm wondering if I go again, will they be able to see anything if there's no stone in the way at the time? Like, or is it even possible that I'm still producing stones?
It's unlikely that you're getting stones that are produced, especially if this is happening at night. The mechanism of why we get gallbladder pain when there's a stone in the gallbladder is when we eat meals that are predominantly fatty in nature, high fat in nature,
yeah.
The gallbladder will contract. The bile in the gallbladder is designed to help mix fatty substances with water, so it's easier to absorb. Just like when you mix lecithin in with a salad dressing
yeah.
with oil and vinegar, if you put lecithin in, it doesn't allow the water and the vinegar to separate it, the oil and vinegar to separate anymore. So it allows absorption to work much better. So when you eat a fatty meal, the gallbladder contracts, the stone that's in the gallbladder gets pushed into the duct, it blocks things up. The gallbladder doesn't like that because it's not able to push anything out, and you get the pain. Okay. If your gallbladder has been removed, it's very unlikely that you have any stone in the other ducts that remain. And the reason is that an obstruction or a stone that blocks the common bile duct, which runs down from the liver down towards the pancreas, if that gets blocked up, you get jaundiced. Your liver gets congested with bile because it can't get rid of it anymore, and you get jaundiced. So you'd see other symptoms. It's quite a severe, and it's painful. I mean, it doesn't stop.
That's what I'm saying I break out into sweat, and it lasts for a couple of hours where I'm just in severe pain right where my gallbladder would be.
Right.
And then after that, I'm like throwing up bile.
So the other issue, though, is that there are other things that can mimic this type of pain.
Okay.
That would make you think that it's gallbladder. And one of the key things that you mentioned, this is happening at night.
Yeah.
Typically what will happen at night is stomach acid production increases.
Okay.
And if you're getting an excess of stomach acid, it can cause nausea, vomiting, severe pain. The pain usually, but not all the time, usually is just below your breastbone, just below.
Yeah, that's right where it is.
Yeah, and it usually will radiate towards the back.
Yeah,
and you're getting vomiting with acid, what you're likely experiencing is excess acid production that's giving you a very similar type of pain. And for this, usually you would use something, and again, you're getting the workup for this, but you would be treated with something to reduce the acid production in your stomach.
Okay, I was prescribed like a Xantax.
That's not strong enough.
Okay.
Usually you want to use a proton pump inhibitor, and there's different ones out there. There's five different types. Zantac is what used to be used as the main medication for that, but it's not as strong to reduce stomach acid secretion.
Okay.
But it does sound like you're getting excess acid produced, and what's worrisome is that you're having severe pain, that kind of pain. The ultrasound will be helpful in that it'll look at the stomach and other surrounding structures. Not going to be that helpful for much else. Ideally, what you're likely going to require is a gastroscopy, a scope to actually look down into the stomach to make sure that there's no ulcers that are forming, given the degree of pain that you're having.
Okay. We have to move on. This will be the last call for this half hour. Pierre in Gatineau. Pierre, go ahead, sir.
Top of the day, doctor.
Hi.
Hello. I'm phoning for my wife. She informed me she had a red mark on one of her breasts there, and she said she feels a lump, but me not being a doctor, I touched it there, but I don't feel nothing, and basically, to me, it looks like a burn or some bug that hit her there, so...
Was it a rash that appeared very quickly? Like, it wasn't there one day and then came the next day?
It looks like this to me there.
Okay. Well,
and is the word cyst, is it the same thing in English?
Yes.
Okay. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, a cyst is usually a fluid-filled sac. And so usually if you feel a cyst, it feels like you're touching a bag that has water in it and that's just sloshing around. That's what usually a cyst is like.
Okay.
But cysts don't usually appear over the course of a day. They usually will build up gradually over time. They usually will get painful if they stretch too much. They sometimes can get infected, but usually those infections are more of abscesses where the whole area gets quite red and tender. What I would suggest is if there is a concern, if she's concerned that there is a lump that's there, and you can get a lump even from inflammation, right? If there's a rash that's formed, if something caused maybe a mild infection in the area, you will get more fluid that comes into that area because it's an inflammatory response. The skin will swell up and it can feel like a little lump just because of the normal inflammatory reaction that occurs, the swelling that occurs in that area.
Okay.
But if it's concerning to her, ideally rashes, you have to see them.
Yep.
Right, they have to be looked at that way. If it is a skin infection, there are very simple treatments for that. But that would be what I would suggest to do. I wouldn't come to any conclusion with regards to what's happening inside the breast until it was actually examined properly.
I made a conclusion for her. I told her to go to emergency there because our doctor is working there today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to,
Okay.
squeeze it. Okay.
All right.
Good luck, Pierre.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
More of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin, who's been busy in the first 20 minutes of the program here, but more of your phone calls coming up right after the 3:30 news. Yeah.
For low fat, this pudding's pretty good.
I can feel the pounds just melting off.
Our new Hyper Sugar gives you 300% of your minimum daily sweetness requirement.
Do you suffer from diabetes?
No.
Well, you do now.
3:42. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday house call. Phone lines are open. 521-TALK, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-CFRA. And again, it's the last open line segment of the year with Dr. Barry Dworkin. He's off to sunnier destinations, Fort Myers.
Yes.
That'll be nice for a week or so. So if you want to make an inquiry about your health or a friend's health or your mother's health or your son's health, we take them all here. 521-TALK, *580-1800-580-CFRA. Lawrence, you're up next, sir. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello, doctor.
Hi.
Doctor, I've been preliminary diagnosed with a rash that is called Grover's disease.
Yes.
I've had a biopsy, but I haven't had the results from it. And I'm wondering, what is Grover's disease? What causes it? Is there any definitive cure for it? Or?
Well, Grover's disease was actually described by a physician named Ralph Grover in 1970, where he had six patients who had this rash that appeared, itchy rash that appeared on their torso, on the trunk.
And that's where mine is, doctor.
Yeah, and it eventually disappeared on these patients. They don't know exactly what causes it. That's one of the issues because it's so rare. In fact, out of 30,000 skin biopsies that they had done for people who had rashes on their trunk, 24 had Grover's disease. So it's extremely, extremely rare. And because there's been no published clinical trials with regards to treatment, it's always been based on case reports or expert opinions, a clinical experience on how to treat it. And so what they've devised then, by no means is this coming off the top of my head. So I have to tell our listeners that I'm getting this information from one of my websites. It's a rare disease. So it's not as if it just popped into my head.
But this is a reliable website.
But it's a reliable website. Yeah. And there are different approaches to treating. And the first line of approach is avoiding any triggering factors. And one of the most common things is heat and sweating seems to be associated with the development of this condition. Using moisturizers and emollients to try to help calm the skin, and using also topical corticosteroids, usually what we call the fluorinated steroids. They're more high-potency ones to try and calm it down. The second line treatment for this is usually topical vitamin D analogs, so topical agents. You treat for 3 to 4 weeks before assessing a clinical response, and also using oral antihistamines. So that's over-the-counter anti-allergy medications.
I see.
And the third line is using steroid by mouth, so usually prednisone, or using...
That's a nasty thing.
Yeah, it is. And then there's also using isotretinoin, which is used to treat acne, but at the same time, it's a vitamin A analog that's taken by mouth that can sometimes help. It's usually taken for 2 to 12 weeks. And then there's also phototherapy that can be used, which is using ultraviolet light and some medication they put on the surface of the skin when they do that. So that's sort of the approach. So there's a lot of stuff that's still available to you to try and treat this, but the problem is very rare condition, not life-threatening in any way, doesn't spread to other parts of the body, usually associated with the trunk, but at the same time, because of the lack of or the scarcity of information, the treatment of the rash is based more on how other rashes are treated as opposed to this one in particular.
I see. Well, that gives me a good picture, doctor, and we'll see what the biopsy shows.
All right.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Good luck, Lawrence. Thank you for your call. Douglas in Orleans has a question about a tear in the rotator cuff. Go ahead, Douglas.
Yes, hi. Doctor. I have a tear in my shoulder, muscle in my shoulder. The family doctor has tried me on anti-inflammatory, to which I was allergic. And right now, all I'm taking is... extra strength Tylenol for the pain, and he tells me it could be up to 5 months if I elect to have surgery. I would like to know what to do for the pain in the meantime.
Usually, if there is pain associated with the rotator cuff tear, first I wanted to ask how severe is the tear? Did you have an ultrasound done of the shoulder?
Yes.
And was it a full? Do you know if they mentioned full thickness tear or partial thickness tear?
They did not mention that. No.
Okay, because those type of things will help determine the severity of the injury. The other aspect of concern to me is the length of time before any surgery can occur. And the reason is that the longer somebody waits with a rotator cuff tear, the more difficult it is to repair it surgically. It becomes a much more difficult situation and recovery time. With regards to treating and treating pain with this tear, it follows a similar process in any pain management setup. That is, you always start with medications that are least problematic, things like acetaminophen and anti-inflammatories, but you already have a reaction to anti-inflammatory, so that's not in the equation anymore. So that being said, there still are other means to control pain, and some people tend to want to avoid using narcotic medications first. They'd rather use other things, and I think that's a good approach, especially you can always add those on later. And again, with narcotic medications, you can end up with constipation, more drowsiness. It's just, especially if you're waiting a long time to be treated, it's just not a fun thing to be on for an extended time. So the approaches to treatment for pain, although, you know, Tylenol would be one or acetaminophen would be one thing, it's not going to cut it completely. So other ancillary medications that are used, some people will use a medication called amitriptyline to use at night. It can help with sleep. It also can help diminish some pain. Other ones are what we call gabapentin is another medication. The brand name for that is called Neurontin. Gabapentin can be used as you gradually increase the dose. These are non-narcotic medications, and they're not specifically designed to be, they never were specifically designed to be pain medications, but they have that indication for more chronic pain treatment because it interferes with how the nerves communicate pain to the brain. The other one is called pregabalin or Lyrica. That also can be used in concert with the acetaminophen. If those in combination and you've increased the doses to a point where you should have had an effect, if those don't help or the side effects are too much, most common side effects are drowsiness, then the next step would be to use a weaker narcotic agent to be able to treat that. Usually there's a patch that can be used, which is a weaker agent. I tend to stay away from codeine. Codeine is really not a great drug to use for pain management because what has to happen first is codeine has to be converted by your liver into morphine. And about 15% of people don't have the enzymes to convert codeine into morphine, and so that doesn't work very well. So that's typically when you hear people say, I take codeine, it doesn't help me. They're not addicted. They're not pretending that they're not hooked on anything. They're just not working for them. And then it's a stepwise approach. Then there's also the physical therapy aspect, trying to help the muscle stretch out a bit without damaging it, applying heat to the shoulder to try to make the muscles relax. So it's not just medications. It's an entire package of treatment and also support for the shoulder. And ultimately, I think what would be helpful is not only with the rotator cuff tear is to have a sports medicine specialist take a look at the shoulder if that's not happened yet, to also give some advice as to a means of promoting better healing of the shoulder, and also perhaps if they can to speed up the process if there is a severe tear in the rotator cuff and the indications are that you have a good you're a good surgical candidate for repair, to get seen earlier rather than later.
Okay, we have to wrap it up there.
That's it.
That's all. Listen, thank you on behalf of all the listeners for all the questions and advice and insight that you've offered.
I love doing this stuff.
All during 2011. And you'll be back, of course,
back
in the new year with the Sunday house call and the Wednesday house call and health headlines.
Absolutely.
You're in for health headlines for
the remainder of the week, and then I'm doing health headlines between Christmas and New Year's.
All right.
I'll be here Wednesday with you. Actually, no. You're here Wednesday during Christmas and New Year's.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll be here. So it's not the last.
Not the last. Okay, well, I'll repeat this. We'll have it on tape, and then we'll just repeat this in a couple of weeks.
We'll call it a special edition in 2 weeks.
Thanks again. Good
You're
to
welcome.
See you. Dr. Barry Dworkin and the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA, archived at CFRA.com.